Case number 20-1074, Ladura Watkins versus Robert Healy. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Stella, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Davide Stella. I'm an attorney representing the appellant in this case, Robert Healy. Your honors, this case involves essentially the events of 1 hour of one day 45 years ago, and 42 years before the case was filed. Given the passage of time and the loss of witnesses, the loss of documentary evidence, there is simply no way to fairly litigate this case.
Before we get into the merits, in this case, the district judge denied your motion to dismiss, correct?
Yes.
So why do we have appellate jurisdiction? Normally we can't hear denials of motions to dismiss.
Well, there was an absolute and qualified immunity arguments raised, as well as a statute of limitations issue.
Okay, so if I understand that on immunity, we do have jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine, although I believe that your brief cited 1292B for jurisdiction. I'm not really sure why.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought that was the correct statute for immunity, but I'm sorry.
But apart from the immunity issue, do we have appellate jurisdiction over anything else?
Well, I think in terms of immunity, the issue would be both state immunity from suit as well as federal immunity from suit. But in terms of the statute of limitations, this court has not addressed whether that is included in an immunity appeal. And I think that it'd be an interesting debate. No one, you know, the appellee did not raise it, didn't question jurisdiction. And given the absence of case law from the court, I would not think that, I would think that whether a constitutional claim had accrued would be something that would be integral to an immunity question.
Do you have any case saying that we do have appellate jurisdiction over that?
I have no case from this circuit, Your Honor. No, I looked.
From any other circuit?
I really have not done an extensive amount of research in it. I mean, I know that one case, the Johnson versus City of Cheyenne case, which is from the 10th Circuit, which was decided, I think, last year. I think what that court, if I recall the case correctly, is that there was an appealable issue and there was a statute of limitations issue presented. And the court decided to exercise, I think, essentially a supplemental jurisdiction because it was a clean legal issue that didn't require any factual development or involve factual disputes. But I don't have the site with me, Your Honor. I can provide it for you, but it was Johnson versus City of Cheyenne.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Your Honor, as we were saying, it is certainly impossible to litigate a factual dispute arising from something that happened 45 years ago, and again, 42 years before the case was filed. The essential question in this case is it between 12 p.m. and 1 p.m. on October 21st, 1975, this is 3 years before I was born, whether the accomplice to the murderer found out that the corrupt police officer who was in charge of the operation died. And then he tried to quickly recant, but then law enforcement, coerced him or convinced him to stick with the original story. So in a normal case, there would be the officer who was sitting right there, named Sergeant Schwartz, who died 10 years ago, would be able to tell a jury, I did not tell Mr. Herndon that Gary Vizzana was dead, and he never tried to recant. Okay, that's the testimony you would expect to defend the case when you're dealing with a jury. But given the passage of time, there is no witness to it anymore. The only witness to it is Travis Herndon, right? And so he'll be able to go in front of a jury against two empty chairs. My client is in his late 80s, right? He retired in 1994. He has already been deposed in this related state court case. And he doesn't remember anything, And I don't blame him for that. And if you ask me to tell you about a case that I did 10 years ago without my file, without my notes, without my memos, I wouldn't be able to tell you like what I was thinking or who I talked to or what my legal strategy was.
But we understand that this happened a long time ago. Of course, Mr. Watkins' position would be that he was wrongfully incarcerated for all those years and could not bring any action until he was until the state decided or the county decided not to prosecute him, and that he could not be prosecuted because of lack of evidence. But I guess the question is, how does this all relate to the question of immunity, which is what we have appellate jurisdiction over?
We think that it's not fair to apply a 1993 Supreme Court standard to prosecutorial actions that occurred in 1975. As we explained more in the brief, is that in 1975, there was actually no Supreme Court case on absolute immunity. The doctrine existed, it was not well understood, but from the case law that existed back then, it was broadly applied. So what we see in the case law since Embler, since 1976, is that prosecutorial immunity as a concept has been narrowed significantly, right? And if you compare any decision from this court in the 70s, or even up until the mid 80s, you know, there was no hard and fast line of a prosecutor can't take part in the investigation part of the case at all, or they lose qualified immunity. That is a modern concept.
So what would you say is the date that we should have for the cases on prosecutorial immunity? These actions occurred in 1975. So what do you think should be our starting point on the date of prosecutorial immunity cases?
Your Honor, I think that the best way to look at it is Embler, because the idea—
Embler is after your date, because Embler was 76, right?
Yes, Embler was 76, but if you think about it, if Watkins had filed a case immediately in 1975, right, that Embler would have been decided and it would not have altered history, and that would have applied to the case.
So you agree then that Embler should apply in this case?
Yeah, Embler, and then this court's decision in Hilliard versus Williams. So there was a prior Sixth Circuit case from the earlier 70s that was vigorously litigated and appealed, right? And you know, Hilliard was appealed, and the 1975 decision by this court was immediately appealed to the Supreme Court, who then held it in abeyance pending Embler. Okay, so I'm not sure Hilliard ever became the law of the circuit. And then Embler, you know, vacates Hilliard in light of its decision. And what this court does in 1976, the same, you know, same year as the trial, says that, you know what, there is no claim in Hilliard that survives immunity. There could have been an argument that some part of Hilliard would have survived Embler. But this court, in a published opinion, said whatever the prosecutorial misconduct that occurred in the investigation of the crime in Hilliard, you know, is barred by me, right? And so I mean, the problem is that it's difficult for me to actually try to reconstruct what an attorney was thinking or what impression case law gave. Because when a prosecutor is working under the assumption they have immunity, you know, you can't— later case law can't erode it, because you know, immunity would just be illusory. If I can—
What is your best case to say that in 1975 Healy would have expected prosecutorial immunity?
Okay, well, in the 70s, all right, a prosecutor may have mostly looked at state law for that common law immunity, because the courts, the federal— this is, I mean, in the 1970s, this is an early period in 1983 law. I think a lot of concepts, I believe, that are well developed today were not developed back then.
I just asked you a simple question. What is your best case to say that there would have been prosecutorial immunity in 1975?
It would have been Bloss versus Williams, and it would have been the first restatement of torts.
Okay, thank you.
There was a whole other aspect of this case on the favorable termination, which I think is a really clear issue here. That the idea is that a termination in favor of somebody for all these constitutional torts would have to be indicative of innocence, right? And we just spent a long time litigating a case of what this microscopic hair analysis means, what the vacation of the conviction meant, right? And the Michigan Court of Appeals recently ruled that whether or not the microscopic hair analysis is in play or not, it does not establish his innocence for the crime, right? Because there was, because the ideas of whether the MHA was inconclusive or it might have been something subject to cross-examination. I see my time's expired.
Can you finish your sentence, sure.
That taking away that piece of the puzzle combined with the remainder of evidence that was presented at trial does not exonerate Mr. Watkins. And the position of the Wayne County prosecutor is that Mr. Watkins has not been exonerated for this crime.
Thank you. And I see you've requested 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mueller.
Good morning, Your Honors. I just want to address, first of all, the issue of absolute immunity. We'll go to that first. Buckley versus Fitzsimmons is the law. And as was discussed in the motion for reconsideration and the opinion of Judge Lightman, a very well-reasoned decision, it has retroactive effect. It would be the law in 1975. And Judge Moore, you indicated what might be a case in 1975. We would look at Hilliard versus Williams, what Judge Lightman called Hilliard versus Williams 1, 465 F second 1212. That's the Sixth Circuit case from 72, which said that in a Brady violation, there was only qualified immunity. And if you notice, Hilliard and Imbler both referred to Robichaud v. Ronan, the Ninth Circuit case from 1965, which discussed the functional approach. So that is the application that would have been applied back in 1975. And I'll note the Wendrow decision also discusses the functional approach, which is a 2013 case. Judge Moore, you wrote that opinion. Activities in looking for clues and corroboration to establish probable cause, there is no absolute immunity for that. And in Spurlock, the Sixth Circuit case in 23, I think it's really important. This quote is, where the role of an advocate has not yet begun, namely before an indictment, absolute immunity does not apply. This is a motion to dismiss. All the factual allegations are accepted as true, and the court's job is to determine if there's some reasonable, plausible way that discovery is going to discover illegal conduct. In this particular case, we didn't have probable cause until they fabricated the evidence of probable cause. And if you're looking at who is doing what, and we take the functional approach of we look at the function and not the title of the person, these are two people acting as police officers interrogating a witness and then threatening him in order to establish probable cause. So under the motion to dismiss standard and absolute immunity, certainly this case survives the motion to dismiss. There is no absolute immunity for actions taken in fabricating evidence. And that's the Buckley versus Fitzsimmons factual standpoint, where the prosecutor conspired with an expert to fabricate probable cause with respect to footprint evidence. That's essentially what happened here, is that Healy and Schwartz conspired to fabricate evidence and get Herndon to say that it was Watkins, after Herndon already told them that it wasn't Watkins, that it was he and Vizana. So I think in this case, it's clear under absolute immunity law that absolute immunity does not apply, in this case survives a motion to dismiss. With respect to the other arguments, I think the court is right in terms of appellate jurisdiction. I briefed the issues that were briefed by the appellant, because that's what you should do. But in terms of jurisdiction, I think the statute of limitations and delayed accrual, court would not have jurisdiction. It does dovetail in some respect with respect to the retroactivity argument, but certainly for fabrication, for statute of limitations and heck, I will just say this for the record, that the cases have always suggested that in 1871 under the common law, favorable termination was a requirement. Justice Souter and Heck, in his concurring opinion, said 1983 requires, parentheses, and presumably always has required, a favorable termination. Justice Scalia in the Kalina versus Fletcher case, which was joined by Justice Thomas in 1997, gave an example in the concurring opinion that if a prosecutor was sued in 1871, one of the elements to establish a malicious prosecution case would have been an unsuccessful criminal case, which is a favorable termination. So favorable termination has been the law in the common law since 1871. And this court's decision in Harrison versus Michigan addressed a similar situation to here, where we had a 1986 conviction. That's a 2013 case, a 1986 conviction, where this court said that there was no cause of action until 2008. And the McCune case from 1988 in the Sixth Circuit, where Judge Guy in a concurring opinion said, if vindication is necessary for your claim, you have no claim until you are vindicated. That is absolutely this case. Ladura Watkins did not have a claim until 2017. And in terms of fabrication of evidence, the McDonough case also discussed that. That's the 2019 Supreme Court case. So I think if we look at two, Dunn versus Tennessee from 1982, 12 years before Heck was decided, this court said favorable termination is required in order to have a malicious prosecution case. That, as Judge Lightman stated, was not some abrupt departure from previous law. That was the law.
If I could take you back to the malicious prosecution claim under state law, would we be applying state immunity law there?
No, I think the state law, ultimately the Supreme Court said state law doesn't apply because the Michigan state law has something different than the Sixth Circuit under federal law. Michigan state common law and malicious prosecution actually requires malice, but under Sykes, the malice is not an element. So you wouldn't be applying, but in terms of favorable termination, I will cite this court's opinion in Wolf versus Perry, which is 2005. Judge Moore, you were on that panel, and they discussed Cox versus Williams in 1999, Michigan Court of Appeals case. In that particular case, it discussed favorable termination and the abandonment of formal abandonment of proceedings by the prosecutor. That's Cox versus Williams. I will note this, in this particular order, it says that the new evidence, which was the new FBI hair evidence and Julie Hauenstein's affidavit, new evidence makes a different result probable on retrial. Insufficient evidence exists to retry defendant, and the people thus move the court to dismiss the case without prejudice. So to answer your question, Your Honor, looking at Wolf versus Perry and also the recent case from 6 months ago, Jones versus Clark County, where they discussed a dismissal without prejudice, it was with respect to Kentucky. But it said, it discussed restatement second of torts, section 659 and comment E, where it said, if there's a formal abandonment and a motion to dismiss, that is evidence of a favorable termination, where they relied on the instance in that case where there were no new charges and no new evidence. In this particular case, since 2017, there's no new evidence and no new charges against Ladura Watkins. So for those reasons, Your Honor, there's clearly a favorable termination in this particular case. And again, I would direct the court's attention to Wolf versus Perry, where they discussed the Michigan law.
That's right, Mr. Mueller, we've talked about absolute immunity. Is the issue of qualified immunity before us today?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's been even addressed, even partially.
It's addressed in appellant's brief at pages 45, 43, 44. They talk about qualified immunity. The purpose of qualified immunity is essentially the same, and they talk about the standards, but it's your position that why are we not to consider qualified immunity?
I considered it, frankly, it wasn't briefed very thoroughly. It was briefed in less than a page and a half, so I think that would be way, but I will say this about qualified immunity. Certainly, the case law says that if you're conspiring to fabricate evidence and conspiring to manufacture probable cause, immunity is not available. I think neither absolute immunity or qualified immunity, because that would have been clearly established in 1975 as well from the cases I've talked about.
Was qualified immunity raised below and ruled on below?
It wasn't ruled on below. In fact, Judge Lightman discussed that in his motion for reconsideration opinion that there was titled absolute immunity and qualified immunity. And then the brief and the argument discussed completely nothing but absolute immunity. Okay. So that's in Judge Lightman's opinion.
All right. So you'd have us rule that it's forfeited by not being preserved below and then not being argued in a, at least a comprehensive way on appeal, or
that's my argument, Your Honor.
More than a perfunctory reference to it. I don't think it's stated in the statement of issues. They talk about immunity in general, and then they cite really cases about absolute immunity. All right.
I think if you look at the entire record from the court below and even through the briefing here, the issue has been nothing but absolute immunity from any substantive basis. So,
all right. So when on remand, that would still be an issue for the district court then, right?
I think that would come up in summary judgment, which I think would be where it would be more
appropriate. Now, they're arguing that because of the passage of time that this case can't be tried fairly, but that really isn't an issue today before us either, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. And I will cite the fact that Jackson versus City of Cleveland, which this court decided, was a 1975 wrongful conviction as well. So this idea of it can't be tried fairly and that's unfair to us, that doesn't have anything to do with the legal arguments today, certainly not on a motion to dismiss.
Sure. All right. Okay. Thank you.
I don't know if there are any other questions, Judge Moore?
I have one question on the appealability under Michigan, of the Michigan state claim on prosecutorial malicious prosecution. Is the law of Michigan applicable on absolute immunity there, or is it the federal law?
If I understand your question, so,
yeah,
right.
There's a state claim on malicious prosecution, right?
Correct.
The common law claim. So what law determines immunity and appealability of immunity vis-a-vis that state claim?
I think the state claim, it would be a malicious in terms of absolute immunity, would be state law, but the state law relies on the federal law in terms of immunity and discusses the state cases, discuss cases like Buckley. I think there would be an application of federal law in determining that.
I think actually the state law immunity is broader than the federal, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't require maliciousness by the prosecutor, and the federal law doesn't.
The state law requires for a malicious prosecution claim, malice. That's correct. Malice. And Sykes under federal law doesn't. But with respect to, I think that with respect to just the issue of absolute immunity, or it would be the same analysis under the functional approach. Okay. But I think I answered that. But that's the way I read the state law claim. Certainly, the elements for malicious prosecution are different in Michigan state claim than Sykes.
Sure.
If there are no other questions, I think we've addressed absolute immunity. We addressed the favorable termination under Wolf versus Perry and Jones versus Clark, and certainly Heck applies. You don't have a cause of action, and Ladura Watkins did not have a cause of action until 2017. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Stella, your mute button is on.
Yes, thank you. I want to address the qualified immunity waiver issue. So the qualified immunity argument below is the favorable termination argument. And that was presented, that the only reason why the district court even could address it, you know, is the idea is that part of qualified immunity is making out a constitutional violation. And you have to allege a violation of clearly established law. So if there's no favorable termination to the criminal proceedings, then qualified immunity would attach. It's not a standalone argument. It would not have been cognizable probably in a motion to dismiss. It was not in the context of qualified immunity. And the Judge Lightman thoroughly addressed it. So the idea is that this is not a new argument on appeal, and I don't think this is a waived issue. I think this is a really clear issue.
Did the district judge say that he was denying the motion to dismiss on the basis of qualified immunity?
I don't have the opinion in front of me, but I think that's what, I mean, if those words weren't used, I think that's what would have happened. I think that, you know, in any event, it's just such a, I mean, to me, the favorable termination thing is such a clear legal issue. You know, that this court has decided two cases in the last 2 years, Parnell versus City of Detroit and Jones versus Clark County, that have adopted and discussed this indicative of innocence, you know? And the idea is that does the dismissal order, okay, was it the case dismissed in such a way to positively indicate that Mr. Watkins did not commit the crime, or is it just leave that question ambiguous? And if the question is ambiguous, there is no favorable termination. And the idea is that, you know, I mean, we went through this in the state court. We spent years litigating the issue of what the basis for the dismissal was, the microscopic hair analysis. You know, there was, you know, Mr. Watkins did not submit any new report. He just submitted the same affidavit that he submitted to the state court. He didn't expand on what Dr. Hollenstein had to say. We submitted a massive rebuttal of Dr. Hollenstein's thing. And, you know, the Michigan Court of Appeals held that if you take microscopic hair analysis out of the conviction, that does not indicate that he didn't do it. Okay? You know, and I feel like, you know, to have us go back and have to, you know, take discovery of my client who has no memory of this, has already been deposed, you know, to avoid what I think is a very sort of straightforward legal issue. It does not need factual development. No facts are going to change that outcome. And what the district court judge did, and what Judge Lightman actually did, was rule as a matter of law that the proceedings terminated in favor of Mr. Watkins. So the district court didn't even leave us any room, you know, apparently to argue that it didn't terminate in his favor. So, I mean, I think that is really, of all, you know, the issues that are presented in the appeal, that is just the easiest one to do. And that would take out both the federal and the state claims, because Michigan state law has the same requirement. And so in terms of the
your argument then is that the favorable termination issue is part of deciding whether or not there's qualified immunity. Is that how we have jurisdiction to consider it?
Yes.
You know, I've got a question. Under Heck, isn't part of the question of whether it's a favorable termination is when it's been declared invalid by a state tribunal? And clearly the conviction was declared invalid by a state tribunal here, right?
Judge Gilman, so this court has adopted in Jones versus Clark versus Clark County in 2020, just this year, incorporates the restatement's view of the dismissal of a criminal case. It can't just be a dismissal. It has to be indicative of innocence. So there's an extra part of this. It's not just every criminal case that's dismissed for whatever reason, you know, is a favorable termination. It has to indicate, because malicious prosecution has to do with that the prosecution was unreasonable, right? And so just because there's a technicality or some witness might do something later doesn't undermine the reasonableness of bringing the criminal case in the first place. That's the gravamen of malicious prosecution. Like, this case never should have been brought, you know, because it was completely baseless from the start, right? So the idea is, so if later down the road, years, decades, 40 years later, becomes some technical issue that we understand better today than we did back then, or whatever, right? Is setting aside on that prosecution unreasonable, you know, like they shouldn't have done it. And that's really the essential inquiry for malicious prosecution, is that was this so baseless and so malicious, not malicious, was this so baseless that we shouldn't have had this case in the first place?
Any further questions from the judges? Well, we thank you both. We thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted.